Greetings and welcome to this May 2019 Buro News Update. I'm your host for this segment, Jim Campanella. Freaking out yet? I'm sure Tony Smith's first listen to this made him wonder whether I sent him the wrong file for inclusion into the Starship Sofa, but you're in the right place. I will eventually get to a couple of regular science update stories, but this first portion of the podcast is partially a review of a classic, or what should be a classic, speculative fiction book of the 1980s, and some of the physics of martial arts, oddly enough. And I'll get to that soon enough. The book that I'm interested in is called The Far Arena by Richard Sapir. Sapir wrote several standalone SF novels, but he is probably most famous for co-authoring the Remo Williams Destroyer novels and co-inventing the fictional martial art of Sinanju along with Warren Murphy. Because these books are considered pulp novels written for the masses, and rather silly at times, he and Murphy, despite writing a myriad of other types of stories, have always been considered by many to be rather second class compared to more quote-unquote serious genre authors. The Far Arena, despite being a bit dated in 1980s politics and science, is an extraordinary piece of writing by Sapir. It's not just an SF adventure story of sorts, but it's an amazing commentary on how humans really change very little, even as society itself changes and brings us to believe that we've advanced a great deal. The story begins at a secret oil prospecting site in the Arctic somewhere. The crew up there is led by geologist Lou McArdle, and they find a body frozen in the ice, under meters of ice, in fact. And because it's several meters down, the body has obviously been frozen in the Arctic for a very long time. Lou McArdle gets permission from his company, the oil company, to take charge of the body and leave the site and go down to Norway, to Oslo. Fortuitously, in Oslo, Lou simply intends to turn it over to the authorities, but he finds a Soviet cryonics expert, and Lou turns the body over to him. The cryonics expert does not believe that the body is ancient. He thinks he's just saving the life of one of Lou's oil crew who accidentally got frozen in the ice. The Soviet is able to revive the frozen body through his expertise, but he thinks that Lou is lying about where he found it. At any rate, who is this body? We're told in a flashback alternating between the modern world and the ancient world that the body in the ice is Lucius Aurelius Eugenianus, the greatest and most famous Roman gladiator of his age, who lived in about 70 AD at the time of Domitian, the Roman emperor. We eventually find out about Eugenie's life, his loves, the arena, Roman politics of his time, and why no historian knows his name, and eventually how he ended up frozen in the far north. I will give you no spoilers on these points, since Sapir did his homework and describes in wonderful historical detail the lost Roman world. But I will tell you about a martial arts concept that I learned years ago that was only reinforced by this reading. The idea is that there are only so many ways to hit, punch, or kick someone. I learned this from my own sensei. And if you study martial arts over enough years, and do not limit yourself, you begin to see this very thing. Whether you study Kung Fu or Judo or Savate or Jiu-Jitsu, there are themes that you will see over and over and over again, even though they may bear different names. Physics and proper form limit how you would apply an attack. Successful martial arts systems evolve to the point of efficiency. Forms that do not work are lost because the proponent of that form did not survive to teach it to others. I'm sure I'm not the first one to apply the concept of evolution to martial arts. People who do not perform martial arts often see the application of skill and a mastery of a martial art as almost mystical. And in fact, many martial artists perpetuate this myth. The idea of chi is not redirection of mystical body energy. The energy that you're redirecting and controlling is completely present and physical, and it takes someone years to master. I've seen my own teacher throwing someone over his shoulder while in the kneeling position and using no hands. However, this type of throw is no magic trick and requires complete understanding of the physics involving not just your own body, but how kinetic and potential energies are being reapplied to someone else to push them down and off balance. The primary art that I've learned is Japanese sword. But in reading what Sapir writes about Eugenie the Gladiator, I was excited by how weapons experts over the centuries have probably found common themes as well. Again, because physics and proper form and application force a group of practitioners to evolve their art in a certain direction. Here was the first point that I noted. At one point in the book, a fully revived Eugenie is in a hospital kitchen with the ancient language expert, who is one of the few who can communicate with him. He notices one of the long kitchen knives on the wall and is entranced by it because it reminds him of the arms he used as a gladiator. Let me read Sapir's words to you. "We were too late to be served food, and we went to the food-preparing area called a kitchen, in this Germanic language. It was on the lowest floor of the building. It had large boards for cutting and storage boxes, which preserved things through cold. And when I saw the knives hanging above the wooden workbench, I laughed. Olava wanted to know what was funny, and I climbed on the bench to reach a blade, which, barring the thin, smooth pommel, was one of the best-designed short swords I'd ever seen, well-pointed for thrust and sharp for blocking slash. I pressed the point into the wood. Flexible, too. Beyond belief. One would not find oneself holding a useless pommel with one's life ended at the crack of the blade. Not this one. And it was strong."
"Eugenie, are you sure you were a gladiator?"
Olava asked. "She prepared fruit and bread and cheese herself." "Yes, why do you ask now?"
"The way you handled that knife. You seemed unable to stick it far into the wood. You seemed, well, slow and weak. Have you lost your strength?"
"I would say I'm almost up to my peak, not far off of it."
"But you move so slowly, with so little force."
"I put the blade horizontally into the wood."
"Yes, that's it. It seems so slow and lacking force. There's no force in it. It looks like no movement at all."
"It is deceiving, Olava. Come, mark where the blade went in."
"Eugenie, sometimes the mind plays tricks. Perhaps you wish to be a gladiator, and after so many years in the ice, I don't know what happened to the mind, but perhaps you adopted some way of life that would be appealing to you. You were in a comatose state for a long while here in the hospital, and you are not all that muscular in truth."
I looked at the blade. How did I know she was not right? I did not even know the difference between today and tomorrow, and yesterday, and centuries before. The thrust seemed good to me. I pulled out the blade. So what's so special about this scene? Olava is surprised that Eugenie does not get the knife deeper into the wood, and that he seems slow and weak. Eugenie never had any intention of getting that knife any deeper. He knew his job precisely. This is a principle that has been pounded into my head again and again. Real swords are horrendously sharp weapons. We've been taught by watching Conan and the Lord of the Rings movies that they need to be swung like axes with all our strength. And that's simply not true. You're talking about a 3-foot-long razor blade. Whether it belonged to a gladiator or a samurai, sword movements do not need to be massive or obvious because the sword does most of the work. I actually got tendonitis in my shoulders a few years ago from swinging my own sword so hard that I hurt myself. Because of the pain I created with my bad form, I was forced to learn that because of physics, you only need to direct the sword. Gravity and correctly applied body mass do the rest. Eugenie knew this principle and only applied the force that was needed to know more. He was trained from childhood by a master linista to understand this. The other scene in the book that I found fascinating was a short, very one-sided fight that Eugenie engages in the modern world. Lou, the oil man, does not believe that Eugenie is actually a famous gladiator, because he's only 5 feet tall, and there are no writings about him in the ancient texts. Lou wants to manipulate him into hiding in a cabin in the woods for his oil company's benefit. However, the oil man needs to convince the Soviet doctor and Olava, the translator, that Eugenie is a fraud and should be removed from the spotlight. So Lou recruits a gold medal fencing champion to fight Eugenie and show him up as incompetent at fighting. Eugenie turns this down and kicks the fencer in the testicles. The angry fencer unfortunately finds Eugenie in that same kitchen after the former gladiator has found the kitchen knife. The fencer has removed the cap from his epee and nicks Eugenie on the cheek with it. All hell breaks loose at that point as Eugenie's trained reflexes cut in to protect himself. Here is Lou telling his boss, the head of the oil company, exactly what happened. Eugenie had appeared to move slowly. He caught the tip of the fencer's foil with the tip of the salad knife, and as though the two weapons were soldered, he moved it with the tip until everyone could see he was dominating and directing the fencer's foil. "Like he would hold a 2-year-old's hand and move it around that easily," said McCardle. Then Eugenie, who was half a foot shorter than the fencer, did the same thing with the two fingers on his left hand, while his knife teased the genitals of the fencer. No, Eugenie did not cut him there. Still with a big grin, he pushed his belly into the fencer's belly, then turned around so that the fencer's arm was under his own arm. He was showing the fencer how to move. He yelled into the fencer's ear that he should practice more, and he accused the fencer of not listening properly. Then he took one step back and took off an ear. So what do I find interesting about this scene? Well, again, I've heard this idea of being on top of your opponent's sword for years now in the Japanese form that I practice called Shinkageru, the new shadow school. It dates back to the 16th century of Japan. By having your sword on top of your opponent's and applying the proper physical structure, you can control your opponent's sword. This is a subtle form and very hard to perform, but a master of the form can override even the biggest opponent, just as Eugenie does. Again, what fascinates me is the idea that even going back to Roman fighting styles 2,000 years ago, you will find common themes because there are only so many ways that a sword can be swung or stabbed. Again, I will reiterate my theme. Themes. First, Sapir writes an excellent story about a man out of time and his fate. We have seen this again and again in SF, but Sapir does a masterful job of writing both historical fiction and modern-day speculative stuff. Second, I contend that at a certain level, all martial arts ends up with parallel structure. I contend this because of the limitations of human physical nature. Okay. Let's see if we can cover a couple of traditional science stories here before I quit for the evening. The first actual science story of the night is actually related in a weird way to the Farwarita novel and the science of cryonics. Antarctica is almost the last place on Earth you would expect to be teeming with life. Survival below the temperature at which water freezes should be impossible, especially for cold-blooded creatures that depend on their environment for warmth. But for the enterprising ice fish, Antarctica represents a bountiful place to live and evolve. The ice fish lineage dominates the modern Southern Ocean, and its members famously sport colorless blood, huge hearts, and pretty ample mitochondria. If you remember, the mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell. Dr. H. William Dietrich III of Northeastern University and his colleagues investigated the genome that has led to the evolution of the extreme adaptation of these ice fish. Their work was published this month in Nature, Ecology, and Evolution. The group sequenced 30,773 protein-coding genes from the ice fish. When comparing this new genome with those of other bony fish, the researchers found 373 gene families that were larger than expected, and 346 gene families that looked too small, revealing ice fish-specific genetic quirks.
Nearly 40% of these quirks appeared within the last 7 million years, which pretty much coincides with plummeting temperatures and the rising oxygen levels in the oceans surrounding Antarctica. And yes, this is changing now, but let's not go there. So, how many did these 719 gene families relate to adaptation to the world's coldest marine environment? Here's the really cool bit relating to the far arena. The production of antifreeze glycoproteins in cells prevents ice crystals from expanding and tearing tissues. That's why you can't just take an organism like a rat or a mouse, freeze it, and then expect it to be alive when you're done thawing it. So unsurprisingly, the ice fish have a respectable 23 of these antifreeze glycoprotein genes. Another piece of the ice fish adaptation puzzle is their huge number of mitochondria and polyunsaturated fats in their muscles. These are both present. To counteract the effects of cold on the fish's metabolism and biological membranes, mitochondria naturally produce small amounts of toxic molecules that can actually damage DNA. The high number of mitochondria and the polyunsaturated fat content of the ice fish tissues makes them extra sensitive to oxidative stress, and this shows in their genes. Ice fish have an expanded gene family that prevents oxidative damage. They have 3 to 33 extra copies of these oxidation-preventive genes present. Ice fish are also the only vertebrates to have 2 copies of the DNA glycosylase gene, which produces a protein that removes damaged pieces of DNA from the genome. Beyond the challenges of living in the cold, making their home so far south, ice fish experience the summer midnight sun and prolonged winter darkness. Day length guides the rhythm and expression of hundreds of genes through the circadian clock pathway. How do ice fish keep time when the sun is so unreliable? Well, their genome suggests that they don't bother. The ice fish genome is missing many, not all, but missing a lot of the timekeeping period genes and the cryptochrome genes found in other fish. Apparently, such extreme fluctuations in day length made light-dependent timekeeping less useful to the fish as far as evolution was concerned, and the genes disappeared from the genome because there was no more selection upon them. Somehow, 10 to 14 million years ago, as Jeff Goldblum famously states, quote-unquote, life found a way, in this case in the Antarctic. Although we have known about the peculiarities of ice fish since the earliest expeditions to the remote continent, we are just beginning to start understanding the complex genetic machinery underlying their physiology. The results of the NASA twin study has finally been completed after they've been analyzed for the last couple of years or so. Identical twins, U.S. astronauts Scott and Mark Kelly, participated in the twin study, and it's provided rather unique results. With Scott living aboard the International Space Station for almost a year and Mark living in Arizona, the twins were studied by 10 teams of researchers in an effort to understand the impact that a year in space has on the human body. They did this by examining molecular and physiological traits that could be affected by that time in space. The results were published on April 11th in Science in a paper entitled The NASA Twin Study, a Multidimensional Analysis of a Year-Long Human Spaceflight. One of the main authors, Dr. Susan Bailey of Colorado State, said, quote, "This is the most comprehensive view that we've ever had of the response of the human body to spaceflight," unquote. The teams of scientists studied the twins' physiology, memory abilities, gene expression changes, and more before, during, and after that year. They focused on any variations that could show how Scott's time in space affected him physically. Living in the environment in space is different in many ways, including confinement, isolation, and exposure to environmental stresses like microgravity, radiation, and noise. The team collected physiological, telomeric, transcriptomic, epigenetic, proteomic, metabolomic, immune, microbiomic, cardiovascular, vision-related, and other data over 25 months. After Scott entered space in March 2015, he took blood samples that were sent back to Earth.
Sequencing the components of his blood showed the length of his telomeres changed during spaceflight, and then they changed again when he returned to Earth. Although the team had predicted that his telomeres would shorten while he was in space, they actually grew by 14%. However, within days after returning to Earth, those telomeres shrunk back to their pre-flight length. Several months later, some telomeres were even shorter. Shortened telomeres in general have been associated with aging and health risks like cardiovascular disease and cancer. Gene regulation changes were measured in both epigenetic and transcriptional data. The genes that were most frequently turned on or turned up were those involved in regulating the immune system. That suggests just what kind of stresses he was under. Also, in gut microbiome composition, body weight, carotid artery dimensions, and prepapillary total retinal thickness, there were also changes noted in his gut microbiome composition, his body weight, and even the total retinal thickness that he had. Scott's chromosomes also went through many structural changes, with parts of the DNA being swapped, inverted, and even merged. Most of the changes Scott experienced in space reversed to his pre-flight state once he returned to Earth. However, there were some lasting changes. Roughly 9% of the genes that had changed activity when he was in space stayed that way. 6 months after his return, his immune system was still altered, probably because of the level of stress. DNA repair changes were still upregulated, and some of his chromosomes were still rearranged. Tests of Scott's short-term memory and logic problems showed that his cognitive abilities declined from pre-flight levels. In addition, some factors were significantly affected by the stress of returning to Earth, like inflammation and the immune response gene networks, as well as cognitive performance. The paper noted, quote, "Although our understanding of the physiological and functional consequences of 4 to 6 month missions has increased greatly over the 18 years of continuous human presence on the International Space Station, there is almost no experience with spaceflight length greater than 6 months," unquote. All the studies being done because of missions to Mars that are planned for the near future. Those missions could last up to 3 years, and more long-term studies are necessary to understand the impact of longer durations in space on the human body. So here's the last story of the evening. Are we going to soon see the beginning of the end of pancreatic cancer, or at least maybe a better treatment on the horizon? New research found that the deletion of ataxia telangiectasia group D, ATDC, whose human homologue is upregulated in the majority of pancreatic cancer cases, completely prevents the development of tumors in mice. The work was published online just a couple of weeks ago in the journal Genes and Development in a paper entitled ATDC is required for the initiation of CRAS-induced pancreatic tumorigenesis. Lead author Dr. Diane Simeone of the Perlmutter Cancer Center said, quote, "We found that deleting the ATDC gene in pancreatic cells resulted in one of the most profound blocks of pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma, which faithfully mimics the human disease. We thought the deletion would slow cancer growth, not completely prevent it," unquote. Pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma is an aggressive disease driven by the oncogene CRAS. "The search for better treatment is especially urgent," says Simeone, "given that pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma has the worst prognosis of any major malignancy and is on track to become the second leading major cause of cancer-related death by 2030. The researchers from New York University School of Medicine and University of Michigan focused on acinar cells in the pancreas that secrete digestive juices into the small intestine, which can subject the tissue to low levels of damage. In response, the acinar cells have evolved to readily switch back into stem cell types resembling their high-growth ancestors, a feature that they share with pancreatic duct cells. Those cells are prone to become cancerous when they acquire random DNA changes. including those in the gene CRAS that are known to drive aggressive growth in more than 90% of pancreatic cancers. In the current study, the researchers found that ATDC is required for CRAS-driven adenocarcinoma and its progression. Specifically, mutant CRAS and other genetic abnormalities induced aggressive pancreatic cancer 100% of the time in study mice when the ATDC gene was present, but in none of the same cancer-prone mice that lack this gene. That suggests that the mice lacking the gene are protected from developing pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma. The findings, says Simeone, identify ATDC and several other genes that are signaling partners as potential targets in the design of new treatment approaches and prevention strategies for pancreatic cancer. Well, that's all from me for now. Read the FAR arena, avoid going into space for long periods, keep watching the skies, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.